morning. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be with you this morning. Thank you. But I should warn you about something. George Burns once quipped, quote, "The secret of a good sermon is to have a good beginning and a good ending, and to have the two as close together as possible." Given this criteria, this may not be a good sermon. Now, as anyone who knows me well can attest, I am not an optimist by nature. In fact, when my adult daughter learned the topic for my sermon today, she had a genuine belly laugh. Now, if one believes that genetic and ethnic influences shape personality, my Irish Catholic upbringing should be sufficient explanation in this regard. While my mother was an optimist and often met my tepid enthusiasm for change with a resounding, "Where's your sense of adventure?" my father, in contrast, would eloquently endorse a dimmer view of existence, frequently quoting Shakespeare with a particular emphasis on this line: "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." He actually quoted this at the dinner table with some frequency. Given such developmental influences, I often look askance at toothy positive thinking types who assert that we make our own reality for good or ill. I find this view a little too self-serving and narcissistic, one that's often the province of what I call control freaks. On the other hand, I am not fond of those who don't just visit Pity City once in a while, but actually permanently move there. So I've often found myself kind of ping-ponging back and forth between what me worry, rose-colored perceptions, and melancholic, brooding realism. So let's briefly consider each position in this philosophical debate. On one side, we have the power of positive thinking. It is proposed as the optimal mindset for addressing many of life's challenges, including overcoming illness, battling depression, recovering from personal losses, resurrecting a dashed career, and just generally re-gluing one's existential Humpty Dumpty once it's tumbled from the wall. On the strictly positive side, it is heralded as a way to become one's best, to push beyond personal or culturally imposed limitations and achieve one's dreams. All this and more, we are told, flows from simply looking on the sunny side and staying focused on what can be rather than what cannot. There are many successful adherents to positive thinking who proselytize about how it rescued them from their failings or allowed them to access untapped inner potential. We hear and are uplifted by accounts of people who have prevailed against life-threatening diseases or daunting physical challenges, such as cosmologist Stephen Hawking, actor Christopher Reeves, Helen Keller, and many others. We are dazzled by accounts of those who lifted themselves out of poverty or disadvantage to become icons of the American dream, such as Bill Clinton, Oprah Winfrey, Barack Obama. In fact, the belief in the capacity of positive thinking to bring good to our lives is fundamental to American culture. Our emphasis on the primacy of the individual, personal responsibility, and pulling oneself up by the proverbial bootstraps is pervasive in movies, books, popular culture in general. As playwright Mary McCarthy said, "The happy ending is our national belief." Now, several years ago, a book called The Secret, any of you read The Secret? I see a few heads nodding. Took positive thinking, combined it with some recent research into intentionality, threw in a bit of quantum physics, and asserted that we are quite literally the sculptors of our own realities. While offering some new slants on an old subject, this book distilled down to a central message: belief creates reality. And, it asserts, if one's beliefs are optimistic, the resulting reality will prove a good one. However, after I read it, I heard a little voice in my head say, "You know, some days you are the bug, other days you are the windshield." In summary, positive thinkers maintain that the locus of control over our lives resides within ourselves and our own mental attitudes. Their mantra is, if they have one, what you see is what you get. On the flip side, we find the naysayers, the Stoics, and cynics, basically pessimists. To them, the locus of control in our lives resides outside of us in forces such as fate, accidents, destiny, and luck, good and bad. It's not that all such people expect the worst. In fact, many of them hope for the best, or at least something better. They differ from their positive counterparts in that they don't believe they can control the forces that move and shape their lives. As one remarked to me, quote, what you see is not what you get. What you get is what you get. Basically, such people consider themselves gamblers in a cosmic game of dice. Maybe they'll get lucky, but they don't want to get their hopes up. Pessimists believe they possess a realistic perspective on life, and if you accuse someone of being a pessimist, they'll often say, I'm a realist. One that is obvious once one removes the rose-colored perceptual filters of their optimistic counterparts, as Mark Twain once remarked, the man who is a pessimist before 48 knows too much. If he is an optimist after it, he knows too little. This reflects the philosophical foundation of pessimism, grassroots experience with the school of life and its many hard knocks. To folks like Twain, optimism is a cognitive dysfunction caused by insufficient life experience. Now, most naysayers can back up their dour attitude with countless examples of people who employed positive thinking to better themselves and stand toe-to-toe with life's challenges, but still failed. In fact, each side in this debate hammers away at the other with convincing anecdotes that attempt to prove their respective positions. But philosophical differences aside, the question for each of us remains this. When life is challenging or just outright overwhelming, what attitudinal posture should I take? Is it best to grab existence by the horns, put on a happy face, as we said, and compel events to move in one's favor through the sheer force of positive will? Or is it better to accept one's fate, go with the flow, be it good or ill, and make the best of what is bad and unlikely to get better by one's own efforts? While there are probably shining optimists among us today, I suspect even they have dark nights in their souls, that they labor through doubts and feel the emotional intimidation of daunting odds. After all, faith, like faith, optimism that has not been tested is not to be trusted. I also suspect there are some curmudgeons out there who have enjoyed certain moments made brighter by hopes and dreams, and who have episodes when they experience better times by virtue of their own efforts, not just from the arbitrary movements of the universe's existential tumblers. But whatever your attitudinal pedigree, happily, there is a middle ground between Norman Vincent Peale and Eeyore. And within that, most of us can find the footing to handle the challenges and suffering that life places at all doorsteps sooner or later. The labelers call this attitude realistic optimism. And rather than being simply a glib way to meld two seemingly paradoxical views, optimism and pessimism, it is an existential posture in its own right. Realistic optimists display what legendary Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton called moral courage. This Irish gentleman led an expedition to Antarctica in the early 20th century, one that became trapped in sea ice, faced starvation and despair, and yet emerged 2 years later without losing a single soul. This astounding adventure, which is often called the greatest survival story of all time, was a life or death demonstration of the power of realistic optimism. Like Shackleton, realistic optimists know they are not the sole masters of their destinies, that fate can and will confound them with obstacles that can be difficult, if not impossible, to overcome. They also know that human will and intention are forces in their own rights, and that, within limits, they too can influence events, although not in an all-powerful fashion. But how does this constitute moral courage? Genuine courage is not born of pie-in-the-sky optimism, a view suggesting that any impediment can, with sufficient effort, will be overcome. Giddy optimism can sometimes mask underlying fear, not metal. Nor is it a product of it's no use pessimism, the kind that refuses to acknowledge that near miracles do happen, and sometimes even result from the application of individual will and positive persistence. Courage occurs when one recognizes the difficulties and dangers in any given situation, and yet chooses to act in a manner that applies the human power of positive intention, even if it carries no guarantee of tangible success. Moral courage is more than simply trying to succeed or prevail in the presence of formidable barriers and risks. It is the belief that one can prevail, not that one will prevail, but that one can. As Yoda from Star Wars admonished us, do or do not, there is no try. But a realistic optimist, the doing does not carry with it any certainty of achieving a positive or desired outcome. Let me explain. What it does contain is the certainty of moral victory. As Mahatma Gandhi told us, satisfaction lies in the effort, not the attainment. Full effort is full victory. This is an essential precept of this particular attitude towards life. There's a story some of you probably heard of a man walking on a beach covered with starfish, washed ashore by a big storm. Surveying the vast array of stranded creatures, he notices a boy throwing the starfish back into the sea as fast as he can. Approaching the boy, the man says, "Young man, there are so many starfish washed ashore, you can't possibly make a difference." But the boy just picked up another one, threw it into the water, and said, "I made a difference to that one." Realistic optimism has its genesis in the human spirit, not in mere thinking, positive or otherwise. It is morally courageous to meet life's trials with intention that one will apply full effort, no matter the odds or the eventual outcome. It's possible, then, for us to stand face to face with a terminal illness, for example, knowing we will likely not win that battle, but with the conscious intention of living fully and positively through full effort. And given that each of us suffers from a terminal illness called life, this is not a consideration that is particular to those who've been given an end date for their earthly existence. The realistic optimist recognizes that, essentially, the greatest challenges in life do not reside outside of us, but within. As author Grace Lichtenstein noted, quote, "Your opponent, in the end, is never really the team on the other side of the field, for instance, or the trouble that's bedeviling your existence. Your opponent is yourself, your negative internal voices, your level of determination." The realistic optimist does not look out there for her or his challenge, but in here. But how do they do that? There are two factors that come together to create a realistic optimist. One is a practical skill set called the power of intention. And the other is a spiritual capacity called present hope. Let's briefly consider each of these powerful ingredients. There's a growing body of research into the power of intention and its impact on human behavior. Long ago, this was recognized as an essential skill for athletes. And this psychological methodology is sometimes called, and you've heard of it as such, mental rehearsal. By whatever name, it is the cognitive toolkit of the realistic optimist. Often confused with visualization, which we hear about all the time, mental rehearsal is, in fact, a much more elaborate multi-sensory experience. It involves mentally rehearsing how one will act and feel in a future situation or challenge by imagining that one is already in it. Seeing out through one's own eyes, hearing the sounds of that moment or experience, feeling the sensations of being there, even smelling the aromas, feeling it. In contrast, visualization often involves just kind of seeing oneself in a future scenario, as if watching a movie of oneself in the mind's eye. How powerful is the effect one can create by applying the power of intention? Well, one example is taken from research done at the Cleveland Clinic, where physiological studies were conducted on two groups of people. Those who underwent and were supervised with a highly structured workout to build up their physical strength, and those who simply mentally rehearsed the same workout but never actually did the exercises themselves. The result? During the trial period, those who actually exercised increased their muscle mass and strength by an average of about 30%. While those who merely laid on the couch and used mental intention to exercise increased their muscle mass and strength by a lower but still remarkable 14%. That's the reaction I always get to that. I'm going home trying to lay on the couch and imagine myself exercising. This and additional research shows that in many situations, our brains do not distinguish significantly between real external experiences and richly imagined internal ones. If you'll recall a vivid dream you've had, this tendency will be apparent. Your brain treats it as reality, even when your conscious mind says otherwise. So, through the power of intention and mental rehearsal, we can prepare ourselves to fully meet a wide array of life challenges, and that is precisely what realistic optimists do. They know they cannot completely control the odds, but they also know they can sometimes tip them in their favor, and they mentally prepare themselves to do just that. We need to remind ourselves, however, that conscious intention is not simply wishful thinking or some glib New Age ritual. It is a process that activates mental rehearsal within a realistic, not an idealistic, framework. It incorporates the possibility of failure into the imaginative process by invoking a pragmatic representation of the challenges involved. For example, as Michael Jordan put it, quote, "I have missed more than 9,000 shots in my life. I have lost almost 300 games. And 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I have failed over and over and over again. That is why I succeed." It is the possibility of defeat or failure that balances out a person's can-do optimism and affords a realistic approach to the challenge at hand. In essence, Jordan succeeded not only due to his innate talent, which was considerable, but also because he prepared himself through mental rehearsal to do his best each time he took the floor. Doing so did not ensure his success in any given game or playoff, however, it did ensure his success as a realistic optimist. He knew he would not always win, but he went into every contest intending to bring his best. And most importantly, he viewed his effort and performance rather than the outcome or the score as the ultimate measure of that success. That's the mechanics of realistic optimism. But what about its essence? Drawing out the Michael Jordan example, we have his coach and mentor, Phil Jackson, This realistic optimist introduced Jordan to the other essential element necessary for full effort: immersion in the moment. Within the context of realistic optimism, we refer to this force as present hope. When most of us hear the word hope, we think of the future, what we wish for. But for the most part, future hope is not the province of realistic optimists. They recognize that future hope is a gamble, a bet that things will turn out as one planned or expected, and rarely does this occur. It's a principle of modern psychology that mental health requires something called hope structure, a set of beliefs that are forward-looking and essentially optimistic. But wagering one's optimism on a future outcome can be a fool's bet. This was brought into sharp relief by psychoanalyst Viktor Frankl in his seminal work, Man's Search for Meaning. Frankl, who endured and survived the Nazi death camps, found that his fellow inmates who remained spiritually alive despite the horror around them did so through existential or present hope, living fully, consciously, and intentionally in the now. In contrast, those in the camps who often pinned their hopes on being freed often did poorly in a psychological and spiritual sense, sinking into despair and despondency. Those like Frankl who remained in the moment, deriving whatever meaning and purpose they could from its meager and often cruel offerings, were able to keep their souls alive. And that's what realistic optimists do in the face of negative events and challenges. As Anne Frank put it, quote, "I don't think of all the misery, but of all the beauty that still remains." A realistic optimist finds spiritual sustenance and hope in the moment, not in the longed-for prize, not in the reward at the finish line. She or he finds sufficient meaning and purpose in existence alone to remain positive, not about what will happen next, but about what is happening right now. They recognize that being entirely committed to the moment is how one draws the spiritual power that is greater than the individual. It is not just a psychological act, but also a sacred one, the way to drink from the wellspring of spiritual verve that is available to each of us. As noted anthropologist Joseph Campbell stated, quote, "I don't think people are seeking the meaning of life. What they are seeking is the experience of being fully alive," which is precisely the approach of a realistic optimist, to be fully alive in the hopeful moment. Combining these two forces, the neurologically based power of intention and the spiritually based present hope, this creates the chemistry we call realistic optimism. It is both a cognitive and a spiritual posture towards life. It does not promise you riches, fame, or accolades. It is not a method for getting your way, nor does it suffer those who long for the pot of gold at the end of life's rainbow. As actress Helen Hayes noted, quote, "My mother drew a distinction between achievement and success. She said that achievement is knowing that you have studied and worked hard and done the best that is in you. Success is being praised by others or rewarded by life. Success is nice, but not as important or as satisfying. Always aim for achievement and forget about success." In our nomenclature, what Hayes refers to as achievement is what Gandhi called full effort, what Frankl termed right livelihood, and what Shackleton labeled as moral courage. To wrap up, in 1980, for those of you who are around, when USA Olympic hockey coach Herb Brooks set out to take a ragtag team of college amateurs and pit them against the best professional ice hockey team in the world, the then Soviet Union, he did so not with swooning and unfounded confidence and rah-rah speeches, but with heavy doses of realism set inside a context of positive intention and present hope. He began training his players by showing them many films of the Soviet hockey team in action, a team that was a juggernaut of refined technique, so much so that coming into the 1980 Olympic Games at Lake Placid, New York, they had won 4 consecutive Olympic gold medals, had soundly trounced the NHL All-Star team, and were widely considered unstoppable. Brooks didn't lie to his team. He told them the Soviets were, in fact, better hockey players than they were, had far more training and experience, were superbly conditioned, and that they would be very tough to beat. In short, he gave them a heavy dose of realism. But he also offered them a plan for how to, as he put it, quote, stay with that team. He didn't promise them success. He indicated that if they used the power of intention and combined it with rigorous mental and physical conditioning, as well as a hefty dab of team chemistry that relied on their collective spirit of staying in the moment, they had a chance, that was his word, a chance to beat the Soviet team. In his locker room speech before the decisive game, Brooks did not tell his team to go out and win. This is what he said. This is your time. Now go out there and take it. A very different message. He told them to meet the challenge fully, and that if they did so, they would achieve victory within themselves, even if not on the scoreboard. If they had not won that game, the movie made about them called Miracle, I predict, would never have been made. Because in our culture, we tend to value the scoreboard, the finish line, the outcome, much more than the effort. But Brooks was smart enough to see past that. As some of you may recall, what happened in that game has been called a miracle and is arguably one of the greatest upsets in sports history. It did not occur because of unfounded optimism or resigned pessimism. It occurred because these young men did their best, kept themselves immersed in the flow of the game, embraced moral courage, and became that which they intended to be. While generally less melodramatic and spectacular, each of us arrives at a time in our lives when the odds are clearly against us. It may be a debilitating fear, an arduous task, a health crisis, a personal loss, any situation that requires the stuff of realistic optimism. Whatever challenges each of us is facing now, at this moment in our lives, we will do well to remember 2 things. 1, Herb Brooks' locker room admonition. This is your time. Now go out there and take it. And the statement from Dorothea Brand, who said, act boldly and unseen forces will come to your aid. Thanks very much. Appreciate you listening.